Tonight, it's a real pleasure to welcome Dr. Jason Keller, who's going to talk to us about blue carbon. That's carbon that's stored in the vegetation and soils of coastal ecosystems, wetlands, marshes, eelgrass beds, and so on. Jason is an associate professor of life and environmental sciences at Chapman University's Schmidt College of Science and Technology. His ongoing research engages undergraduate collaborators in the investigation of carbon cycling in a variety of wetland ecosystems, ranging from northern peatlands to salt marshes in California. He's won a number of awards from Chapman University, including the Faculty Excellence Award for Teaching, the Office of Sponsored Research, Young Investigator Award, and Curriculum Innovation in Sustainability in Faculty Teaching. His graduate fellowships included one at the National Science Foundation, and he held a postdoctoral fellowship at the Smithsonian Institution on Chesapeake Bay. He's a member of the California Academy of Sciences, the Ecological Society of America, and the Society of Wetland Scientists. He grew up in the Midwest, in Columbus, Ohio, went to Notre Dame, he got both his BS and his PhD from Notre Dame University, and we've had a great discussion with him already. Please welcome Jason Keller to the aquarium.
All right. Well, thank you, Jerry, for a wonderful introduction and a nice conversation, as you said. And thanks to the organizing committee for having me here tonight. This is going to come as a bit of a surprise to you, but as a nerdy wetland biogeochemist, it is very, very difficult to convince your children that what you do is cool. And being invited to give a talk at the aquarium where there are sharks is as close as I am likely to get to convincing that I am cool. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, excited to be here and talk a little bit about the research that I'm doing at Chapman University. And thank you all for being here as well. As Jerry said, I'm going to talk to you tonight about blue carbon, which is very simply the carbon that we find in vegetation and soils in coastal ecosystems, including the salt marshes that we have around us here in Southern California. I want to use this idea of blue carbon to really do three things tonight. First, I think blue carbon is an excellent example of how our perceptions of wetlands have changed over the past 50 to 100 years. Second, those changing perceptions have led to, I think, some very interesting policies in the past couple of years. And many of those policies have important implications for wetland conservation and wetland research. The final thing that I want to do is just share a little bit about the scientific work that we're doing with the undergraduate collaborators that I have at Chapman University just down the road in Orange. So let's get to it. I like to start talks on wetlands with a definition of wetlands. This is the definition of wetlands used by the United States Environmental Protection Agency and also the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. This wetland definition has been around for 30 or 40 years, and it's really how these different government organizations think about wetlands in the context of policy and legal spaces. It's a long definition. You don't have to read it all. I've tried to highlight the key word, which is water, right? Which fits for an aquarium talk, I think. Wetlands are lands that are wet, and so we've really gone out on a limb there with this definition. They are defined most fundamentally by the presence of water. These are systems that are flooded or inundated or saturated for long periods of the year. Those wet conditions lead to really unique soil chemistry and really unique vegetation. And it's those hydrology, that wetness of these ecosystems that really make them so unique and so fun to study from a scientific perspective. To make this a little bit more approachable, I always like to start my talks with a picture of one of my favorite wetlands, which is this one. This is, of course, Dagobah from the Star Wars universe. This is where Yoda lives. This is where Luke went to train with Yoda. I do start with this picture for two reasons. The first is because I am a big Star Wars nerd. And the second is because I actually think it's a really important insight into how we think about wetlands and how we've thought about wetlands for most of the 19th and a majority of the 20th century. And that is that historically, we viewed wetland ecosystems as sort of scary places, right? When Luke flies into Dagobah, you don't get warm, fuzzy feelings, right? It's kind of spooky and there's snakes and it's, you know, it's not the place you want to be, right? This is not a welcoming environment in the Star Wars universe. And I think that reflects in large part how we viewed wetland ecosystems as a society. I think importantly, this is also a place in Star Wars that is very much in the way of progress, right? It's metaphorically in the way of progress of Luke's journey to becoming a Jedi, but it's also directly in progress to the technology, right? This is a place that where you try and land your X-Wing fighter, it sinks in the mud, right? And some crazy snaked fish thing eats your R2 unit, right? This is a place that is explicitly against progress. And again, I think that reflects how we've by and large viewed wetlands in our landscape. If you're not a Star Wars fan, you can see the same mindset and the same thinking in the English language. How many of you have ever been swamped? How many times have you been bogged down in a problem or mired in a conversation? Bogs, swamps, mires are all examples of wetlands, and the very way that we use these wetlands in the English language suggests that we think about them as in the way. These are systems that slow us down. And this view, this historical view, this historical perception that wetlands are somehow in the way, I think has really influenced how we've treated these systems historically. So this is an image put together by Eric Stein and others. At Southern California Coastal Water Research Program, looking at sort of historical ecology of Southern California. We're looking at the Long Beach, Los Angeles Harbor here. So we are sitting kind of right at the base of this. Oops, that's not the button. I was not listening when, oh no. All right, we are sitting right at the base of that red dot right there is the aquarium. So this is what this area of the country would have looked like in right around 1850. So these are data that are coming from T-sheets. These T-sheets were generated by the United States government as they surveyed the Southern California coast for navigational purposes. And the color coding here is really instructive. So all the green blobs on the screen here represent estuarine vegetated wetlands. Those are essentially salt marshes. The light sort of brownish color is unvegetated wetlands. These are essentially mudflats. And then the dark blue color represents sort of open water estuarine habitat. So this is what the area that we are in right now looked like around 1850. Here's what that same area, once again, we're at the base of that red flag. Here's what that same area looked like in around 2005. Right? And you can see here that we've gotten rid of most of the estuarine vegetated wetlands here. We've gotten rid of all of the salt marshes that existed to the west of where we are right now and converted them into open water habitats, primarily harbors and marinas and things that facilitate shipping. Right? And the same thing holds, right? So 1850, 2005, these are just really, really different landscapes. And this view of wetlands is in the way of the progress, I think has allowed us to sort of justify these things. We've taken these pesky wetlands out of the way to develop in different structures in a different landscape that has, at the time, was perceived to be much more valuable. For those of you that really want the visual of it, here's what it looked like yesterday from Google Earth, right? This actually isn't yesterday from Google Earth, but I found it on Google Earth yesterday. You get the point, right? This is not a landscape anymore that has anything like natural wetlands still on this landscape. We've been very, very effective at taking these wetlands out of the landscape, and I think it really comes from this perception of these things as being in the way of progress. The story that we can show for Los Angeles and Long Beach Harbor is not unique. This is how we sort of have viewed wetlands and treated wetlands on our landscapes at a variety of different scales. If you look at the Southern California coast, the area highlighted by the orange box here, it's estimated that we've lost about 75% of the salt marshes that were here prior to European settlement. That works out to something like almost 6,000 hectares. A hectare is roughly equivalent to 2 football fields. So we're talking about 10,000 football fields worth of salt marshes that used to exist along the Southern California coast and are no longer there. When you scale up to the entire state of California, the numbers are even more staggering. It's estimated that California has lost 90% of the wetlands that were here prior to European settlement. Now, of course, we're talking about all types of wetlands, not just salt marshes, but we're looking at almost 4 million football fields worth of wetlands that used to be a part of California that are no longer a part of the California landscape. If you scale this up one more step to the lower 48 of the United States, we've only lost 50%, right? So only 50%, that's almost like a victory. We've only lost 50% of the wetland area in the United States, but that amounts to almost 100 million football fields worth of wetlands that no longer exist within the United States. And if you were to take this up to the global scale, it's really actually very hard to get good numbers, but the best numbers we have suggest that on a global scale, about half the wetlands that existed 200 years ago no longer exist on the entire planet, right? So we've been really good at thinking about wetlands this way, as sort of problems that we need to solve, things that we need to transition into something more valuable. And what I want to suggest is that in the past 50 years, maybe the past 100 years, that perception has fortunately really begun to change. We've moved away from thinking about wetlands as these sort of inherently scary places and started to realize that they can actually be really beautiful parts of our landscape, right? They're beautiful parts of the landscape that provide recreational activities, and they also provide us with a number of other important ecosystem services. They're not just pretty, they do stuff for us. A human society, we benefit from having these wetlands on the landscape. A couple examples of some of those things that wetlands can do for us. And the first one is that we know that these wetlands provide really important habitat to all sorts of creatures that we care a lot about. You can actually see that here at the aquarium, where there is a strong bit of language in the program about the value of wetlands in the shoreboard exhibit. And indeed, we know that wetlands play a really crucial role as bird habitat in Southern California. Just a couple examples of this. At the top, you see a picture of the least tern. This is from the Seal Beach Wildlife Refuge website. You see a picture of the Ridgeways rail, which used to be the light-footed rail. This is from the Upper Newport Bay website. And you see a picture of the snowy plover from the Bolsa Chica website. Three bird species in Southern California that are on the threatened or endangered species list that fundamentally rely on coastal wetland habitats for their survival. And it's not just these three birds. We know that a majority of species on the endangered and threatened species list within the United States of America rely on wetland at some point in their life cycle. Really important habitat. Not just habitat for species that we care about from a conservation perspective, also habitat for species that we care about from an economic perspective, right? When we think about fisheries and shellfish, the food we eat, the seafood we eat, most of those fish and shellfish species are using these wetland habitats as nursery or feeding grounds, right? They are providing the sustenance for the fish that we catch and that we eat all the time. There's a real tangible benefit to having these ecosystems on the landscape. Another important benefit that we've known about for some time, but we keep coming back to in the wetland world, is that these coastal wetlands in particular do a really nice job of protecting us from storm events, right? So if you live in this imaginary city shown up here, you want to make sure that you are protected from big wave events, hurricanes, storms, those sorts of things. Historically, the way that we've guaranteed that protection is to go in and get rid of all of the salt marshes and build a really big wall, right? We're starting to get a little bit nuanced about the way we think about coastal protection and realizing that there's probably some clever opportunities to use green architecture. That is, rather than getting rid of the wetlands, let's keep the wetlands there or even put the wetlands back, because wetlands have been absorbing storm energy for thousands and thousands of years. So maybe there's opportunities to design cities that use a combination of these sort of natural green infrastructure dynamics along with more sort of traditional gray infrastructure like storm walls and that sort of thing. And so my point here is that historically we've thought these things were largely a pain in the rear and we had to get rid of them. We're changing that perception and starting to appreciate the fact that they have value. And I think that adds more meaning to looking at these historical data sets. For me, it means that when I look at the areas that have been lost since 1850, the salt marsh areas that have been lost from 1850, it adds appreciation to the fact that we're not just losing area, we're losing services, we're losing function. Right? Getting rid of a wetland doesn't just mean that we lose the wetland, we lose the habitat, we lose the shoreline protection. We lose all of these other valuable things that wetlands do for us. And I think as a society, we're starting to see that perspective. And that perspective is reflected in a growing interest in conserving and protecting the wetlands that are remaining on our landscape. And is also, I think, playing out in this growing interest of trying to restore wetland ecosystems, putting wetlands back onto the landscape so that we once again have the ability to take advantage of these ecosystem services that they provide to us. One of the ecosystem services, and the ecosystem service that I'm going to spend the rest of my time tonight talking about, is a growing appreciation for the fact that wetlands play a really important role in the global climate, right? They play a really important role in the global carbon cycle, which means that they play a really important role in the global climate. We know that wetlands on the global scale have actually influenced the Earth's climate over geological time. They're that important that temperature changes in the past tens of thousands of years can be linked back to activities within wetland ecosystems. And this really connects back to this idea of blue carbon. So as I said at the start, blue carbon in the simplistic definition is the carbon that we find in plants and soils of coastal wetland environments. A slightly more formal definition from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration from NOAA helps us see the connections between blue carbon and climate and the global carbon cycle. So their definition is that blue carbon is the idea that salt marshes, mangroves, and seagrass beds absorb large quantities of the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it. And they store it again in their vegetation and their soils. And I've underlined greenhouse gases here to make the point that this is ultimately about climate. Right? I think most people in the audience will know that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, which means it's effective at warming the planet. When you have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, regardless of whether it comes from natural sources or human sources, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, all other things being equal, leads to a warming planet. So the fact that these wetlands can take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it for long periods of time means that they can help regulate climate change. They can help slow climate change down. They do this naturally. Perhaps there's ways that we can take advantage of this in current times. I would not be a good ecology professor. Well, I may not be a good ecology professor anyway. I would not be attempting to be a good ecology professor if I didn't take a minute to show some arrows on a diagram showing how carbon moves around the environment. This is what ecologists do. We draw a lot of things with arrows on them. And so I'm just going to take a minute and talk a little bit about the ecology of blue carbon, how it actually gets there, and why it ends up in these coastal salt marsh ecosystems. So the bottom diagram here represents an imaginary salt marsh, which has some plants in it. You'll remember from your sort of high school science classes that plants do this marvelous activity of photosynthesis, where they're taking the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and converting it into organic matter. They're converting it into leaves and sticks and roots and plant parts, right? Organic matter. That organic matter is then the carbon that used to be in the atmosphere that's now entered into this wetland ecosystem. When wetland plants die, they're decomposed. Just like anything else that dies is decomposed, they're decomposed by the soil microbial community that includes things like fungal communities and bacterial communities. As those bacterial communities break down the dead plants, they're actually producing carbon dioxide, which gets released back to the atmosphere. Now, in wetland ecosystems, what makes them so special is that the size of those arrows are consistently different. Wetland ecosystems, for some reasons that I'm going to talk about in a couple of slides, have fairly slow rates of decomposition. And what this means is that the process of photosynthesis takes more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and converts it into organic carbon, then the process of decomposition releases back into the atmosphere, right? So there's a consistent buildup of organic carbon in these wetland ecosystems in the form of partially decomposed plants. Ultimately, those partially decomposed plants end up in the soil as soil carbon. And it's this soil carbon that makes up the majority of blue carbon in these coastal ecosystems. This soil carbon in wetland persists for long periods of time. Right? Soil carbon can stick around in wetlands for hundreds or thousands or even tens of thousands of years. It can represent very, very old pools of carbon that have been kept out of the atmosphere for centuries, if not millennia. And blue carbon systems, including salt marshes, are just really, really good at this. Right? They're the best ecosystems on the entire planet of this idea of taking carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it in their soils. This is a graph from a paper that was released a couple of years ago, and it's showing carbon burial rate. So this is essentially the mass of carbon that is entered into soil carbon pools per unit area per year. So how much carbon gets taken out of the atmosphere and buried in soil in a variety of different ecosystems around the planet. The small bars on your left are forests. We have tropical forests, boreal forests, and temperate forests. The slightly larger bars on the right are the blue carbon ecosystems, so things like salt marshes, mangroves, and seagrass beds. And you can see just from looking at this that these coastal environments are very effective at burying carbon. They're very effective at taking that greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere and sticking it below ground in their soils for very long periods of time. And if you're looking carefully at this graph, especially the students in the third row who have taken my classes before, you will notice that this graph is presented on a log scale, which means that every time you go up a line, you're not going up by a factor of 1, you're going up by a factor of 10. So this graph tells us that a salt marsh is not twice as good or 3 times as good as a forest at storing carbon. A salt marsh is 10 times or possibly even 100 times more effective than a forest at storing carbon in their soils. Right? This means that these salt marshes, the average salt marsh, is up to 100 times better at sequestering carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere than even the densest tropical rainforest that we can find on the planet. They're really good at this. Why? The reason for this is because of this dead man. That's patently untrue. But this dead man does a good job of explaining how this all works. So this is a picture of Tolan Man. How many people have seen this before? Tolan Man is one of these so-called sort of bog mummies that archaeologists periodically find around the planet. Tolan Man, we know from archaeological evidence, died sometime around the year 400 BC in what is now modern-day Denmark. Tolan Man's body wasn't discovered until the year 1950. So what you're looking at here are the remains of a dead Dane that are over 2,000 years old, right? That doesn't happen, right? That was the wow moment. You did it well in the front here. What? Right? That's amazing, right? This is a 2,000-year-old dead guy, and we can still see his leather hat. You can still see the stubble on his chin, and he has this suspicious-looking rope around his neck, which I'm not an archaeologist, but I think tells us something about what happened to this guy, right? You don't find this in most ecosystems. If you're trying to dispose of a body, throw it in a forest where the microbes can effectively decompose it. Don't throw it in a wetland because decomposition is really slow there. The reason why we can have a 2,000-year-old body like this in a wetland environment is because a wetland is wet, right? And as soon as the soil becomes flooded, the oxygen that used to be in that soil isn't there anymore. Oxygen moves 1,000 times more slowly through water than it does through air. So as soon as you flood a soil, you get rid of the oxygen. The microbes that decompose dead things, including dead Danes, but also including dead plants and salt marshes, those microbes want to use oxygen. And if they don't have oxygen because they're flooded, they have to work much slower. So the fact that wetlands are flooded means that there's no oxygen there. They're anaerobic, as scientists like to say. Under those anaerobic conditions, organic matter in the form of dead people or in the form of dead plants decomposes very, very slowly. Now, the other cool thing that allows these coastal wetlands in particular to accumulate so much carbon so effectively, 100 times better than a tropical rainforest, is the fact that these wetlands are coastal. And if you exist on the coast, you have to constantly deal with the pressure of sea level rise, right? Sea level rise is constantly going up. And if you want to remain a marsh, you need to also grow. You need to accrete new soil, which means that these coastal environments are essentially increasing the volume of soil that they can use to store carbon each year. They're adding on a new layer of soil to keep pace with sea level rise. So they're anaerobic, which means that carbon sticks around for a long period of time. They're also basically constantly expanding as they accrete in the face of sea level rise. And it's really these two factors combined that make these blue carbon ecosystems so very effective at doing what they do. So we have a marsh. This is an image that I took at Newport Back Bay a couple of years ago. We now have an understanding that this marsh is very good at storing carbon. It's an anaerobic environment, so carbon decomposition goes very slow. It's keeping pace with sea level rise, so it's constantly expanding its volume. Who cares, right? I think you all should, right? And let me tell you why. It turns out that a lot of people in the policy arena are really starting to care about this idea of blue carbon. And I think there's been some new policy developments in just the past couple of years that make this a really exciting time to be thinking about blue carbon in coastal ecosystems. So this is an image from a report issued by the White House in October of 2014, focusing on enhancing the climate resilience of the United States. So the idea here is that, look, climate change is happening. We need to make sure that we as a society are resilient to that climate change and not exacerbating it, right? And part of being resilient means that you're not exacerbating it. There are four or five key themes put forward in the executive summary, and I've copied the text from the second one of those key themes here. You can't read any of it, but just read the part in big bold stuff at the bottom, right? Part of this theme, one of the key ways that policymakers in the United States think that we can become more resilient to climate change is by securing the continued health of the nation's natural resources that provide carbon biosequestration, including forests, agricultural lands, and inland and coastal wetlands. Right? This is a huge win for wetland conservationists. It means that at the policy level taking place at the White House, they are acknowledging the fact that coastal ecosystems are effective carbon sinks. They're acknowledging the fact that these coastal wetlands are as good as these other ecosystems at taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and keeping it there. This creates all sorts of conservation potential moving forward. If we want to maintain the health of our biosequestration ecosystems, that means that we probably need to think about conserving and even restoring them. It means that we want to be even more careful before we go in and take another wetland off the landscape, because now we know that taking that wetland off the landscape is releasing carbon dioxide that's been in the landscape for 10,000 years back into the atmosphere. It's another layer of policy that we can use to help drive conservation, or we might use that people are exploring to use to drive conservation and restoration efforts within wetland ecosystems. I think another really exciting policy piece that relates to coastal blue carbon is a little bit more local. It has to do with this idea of carbon markets. These are happening at a range of different scales, including some here in California, some in the United States, and some globally. But carbon markets are really this idea that we have now that carbon has some value. And if we want to stop releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, right, to slow down climate change or potentially mitigate for climate change, there's lots of ways that we can do that. But one of the ways that we can do that is to say, if you're going to release some carbon dioxide in one place, you should invest some resources in another place that can take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And these kind of carbon credits are actively being traded on carbon markets right now, in the same way that you can trade stocks on a carbon market. So if I release a bunch of carbon dioxide and I want to pay somebody else to take that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, there are markets in place that allow me to do that. There are two types of carbon markets that are out there right now. The first one is the larger one, and it's a voluntary carbon market. Estimated about $400 million worth of carbon traded on that market in 2014. You know, that's not chump change. That's a real amount of money. Excitingly, just this past year, there was the first ever protocol or methodology released that allowed you to restore a wetland, restore a coastal wetland, quantify the amount of carbon that that wetland was taking out of the atmosphere, and trade that carbon on a voluntary carbon market. This means that if a corporation wants to buy carbon credits, they can buy those carbon credits from a wetland restoration project for the first time ever. So something that's obviously a very sort of exciting opportunity for wetland conservation folks and coastal conservation folks. The other type of market that exists is what's known as a compliance market. And probably the largest example of a compliance market, or sort of a regulated market, it's not voluntary anymore, you have to do it, is here in California. Many of you probably know that California passed Assembly Bill 32 several years ago, the California Global Warming Solutions Act. AB 32 says in part that California hopes to release its emissions of greenhouse gases by 2020 back to what they were in 1990. Right? So we want to go to a place where the amount of greenhouse gases that we're releasing into the atmosphere come back down to what we were doing in 1990. There's lots and lots of parts of this policy. But one of the parts of this policy is a carbon market, where again, people can trade and sell carbon credits, so that if you're releasing too much in one place, you can buy some credits in another place. Now, there are no methodologies that have been approved for blue carbon projects yet. in the California carbon market, but people are actively working on those things, including a number of sort of conservation-minded groups like Restore America's Estuaries, which is up here. But what's already happened as a result of this sort of mandatory carbon market in California is that those markets generate some revenue for the state. And California has decided to use a fraction of that revenue to support wetland restoration efforts. So far, simply because we've been trading carbon, the state has taken a portion of that revenue to the tune of $21 million and used that $21 million to support pilot projects in wetland restoration, the type of projects that we think have potential to eventually be traded on the market for the carbon that they're sequestering out of the atmosphere. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one of those projects just down the road here in the rest of my talk. So I think there are some exciting policy things happening right now. We are really just at the start of seeing how policies built around carbon sequestration and wetlands are going to play out. But I think they have a lot of exciting potential for people that are very interested in trying to fund restoration and conservation efforts in wetland ecosystems. The last thing that I want to talk about is some of the science that I'm doing in my own laboratory over at Chapman University. I am tremendously lucky to work at a university that values undergraduate research. We don't have any active graduate programs at Chapman, which means that every semester I get to bring in four or five really bright students to work on research in my laboratory, and it is a ton of fun. And I'm just going to share some of the successes that we've had on a couple of these projects. I will also point out that we have a really great lab mascot in the Swamp Monsters, and I think without question we have some of the best swag of any of the groups at Chapman. Yeah, sorry, Funk Labbers, you're out of luck. We have a great group. It's a lot of fun. I work with just the students are just ridiculously good, and it's really, really fun to work with them. I'm going to share sort of two projects that we've been working on in my lab over the past couple of years that have to do with blue carbon. And the first looks at soil carbon, and is basically asking this question of, does soil carbon actually accumulate through time? Right? So if we want to trade carbon credits on a carbon market as a result of restoring a wetland, it would be really convenient if we could say that a wetland sequesters or stores this much carbon per year. Right? It'd be really nice if we could figure those sorts of numbers out. Those are the types of numbers that we need to move forward with carbon markets. So we were looking at this, and we looked at this at some wetlands down in Huntington Beach. Many of you are probably familiar with these restoration projects. Huntington Beach Wetlands Conservation or Conservancy has three wetlands in this track right now, Talbert, Brookhurst, and Magnolia, that have been restored over the past 25, 30 years now. And so we, for this project, looked at two of their wetlands that have been restored. The first one was Talbert Marsh. For a long period of time, Talbert Marsh existed without any tidal influence. Right? We cut it off from the ocean. It is a salt marsh. Like all wetlands, it relies on hydrology to be a wetland. We basically cut off that hydrology. Around 1989, the Huntington Beach folks actually restored that hydrology by opening a channel back to the ocean and allowing tidal influence back into Talbert Marsh. About 20 years later, they allowed tidal influence to come back into the adjacent marsh, Brookhurst Marsh. And so at the time that we ran this project, these marshes had been restored for 22 years at Talbert and 2 years at Brookhurst. And the question that we can ask here, if it's not perfectly obvious, is, well, how much more carbon is there at Talbert after 20 more years of restoration than there is at Brookhurst, which is a fairly new restoration site? And so this is fun to measure, right? We take this big, sharpened stainless steel core. Chapman's risk management people love this, so I'm sure they'll look forward to this video. We take this core that's about 6 inches in diameter. It has a razor blade on the bottom, and it's about 2 feet long. We bring it out in the field, and we push it down into wetland soil. This is where it's really nice to work with undergraduates, because what you can do is you can have your undergraduate that can balance on small metal tubes, stand on top of the tube, and then you have some of your less coordinated undergraduates down at the bottom, and they push it down while the person on the top jumps up and down. And we can get these things about 50 centimeters into the soil. Then you have your super strong undergraduates pull this tube out of the marsh, which is not trivial. It is really, really hard to do. One of the students in this picture is Kelly Stump, who was a world-class synchronized swimmer. She's really strong, and she was very, very valuable in this project. So you get Kelly to yank this, you know, tube out of the soil, and then you can slice it up into small increments and measure how much carbon exists in each of those increments. And here are the results for that. So what I'm showing you here is one of a few data slides On the top, you're looking at the percent organic carbon. So this is percent by mass. So for every 100 grams of soil, how many grams of carbon do you have in that soil? And you're looking at this carbon content in Brookhurst in the solid dots and in Talbert in the white dots. And you're looking at how that carbon concentration changes as you go down through the soil profile. So the numbers at the top represent the surface soil. The numbers at the bottom represent 45 centimeters below the surface of the marsh. And this is another one of those wow moments, but you all missed it. It's okay. You can do it now. What? Right? So, yeah, there. Thank you. Right? Just, you got to play along, right? Look, Talbert Marsh, it's 22 years old. How much more carbon does it have than Brookhurst, which is only 2 years old? What? Right? It has less, right? This is the exact opposite of what we thought was going to be going on here. And what it suggests is that this idea that we can go out and look at any wetland and say, give it another year and it's going to have another 5 pounds of carbon in it, is really simplistic and probably not at all accurate. We've continued to look at these questions in a variety of other salt marsh ecosystems up and down the Southern California coast, and it turns out that they don't follow a good trajectory following restoration. You cannot say, after 5 years, any Southern California salt marsh is going to gain this much more carbon. It's more complicated than that. Maybe that's not surprising. We think it has to do with starting conditions. We think it has to do with ecology. There are lots of good scientific questions that we can ask to try and dig into this pattern. But this was really the first glimpse that we had that there's something more complicated going on here than just saying, well, how long has it been restored? This is work that we published in a scientific publication back in 2012 that I'm just really, really proud of, right? This is a scientific publication that has 9 undergraduate co-authors on it, right? Most of whom have gone on to graduate work in the sciences, and I'm just really, really proud of the work that they did on this. I'll also say that the students that were involved in this project were just enrolled in one of my classes. They weren't even research students in my lab. They signed up unwittingly for an ecosystem ecology class, and this is what we did all semester. And I think there's some real value in this sort of model of teaching. Yes, it helps them develop as scientists, but what it also did is it brought 15 students out of the laboratory into the field. They got their feet dirty. They got their hands wet. They actually got to see what a wetland looks like, what a wetland smells like, what a wetland feels like. And I hope that they all left with a deeper appreciation for the value that these ecosystems bring to our landscape. One more set of projects that I'm going to talk about, and this will be the last thing that I'm going to mention here. We talked about the ecology of blue carbon and said that a large reason why we can store carbon in these salt marsh ecosystems is because they're wet and they don't have oxygen, and the lack of oxygen allows for organic matter in the form of dead danes or organic matter in the form of dead plants to accumulate in these wetland environments. Now, it turns out that those very same wet, oxygen-free conditions that allow for the accumulation of carbon in wetland soils also allow for the production of greenhouse gases. They allow for the production of greenhouse gases like methane, which is CH4. They also allow for the production of the greenhouse gas nitrous oxide, which is N2O. Methane and nitrous oxide are really, really effective greenhouse gases. They are very good at capturing energy and returning that energy back to the planet's surface, leading to warming. Methane has a sustained global warming potential of 45 times that of carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide has a sustained global warming potential of 270 times that of carbon dioxide. What that means for the non-biogeochemist in the room, if you release one molecule of nitrous oxide into the atmosphere, you need to take up 270 molecules of carbon dioxide to cancel out the global warming effect. Right? These molecules, these greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, are really, really very effective at warming the planet. And if we're trying to think about wetland restoration as a mechanism to slow climate change, as a way to sell carbon credits on a carbon market to slow down climate change, it is really important that we have a handle on these things. Now, the assumption within the scientific community is that both methane and nitrous oxide should be produced in very small quantities in salt marsh ecosystems. And it's a pretty good assumption. It's based on very good science. But it's assumption nonetheless. And if we're going to try and start selling carbon credits, I think it's an assumption that needs to be tested. And this is something that we're doing an increasing amount of work on at Chapman University, going out to a variety of these wetland projects that have interest in sort of quantifying their carbon impact, their greenhouse gas impact, and looking to see the amount of methane and nitrous oxide that's being released and produced. I'm just going to talk about one of those projects because it takes place just down the road at the Seal Beach National Wildlife Refuge, one of the few remaining wetlands in this area that's been here since 1850. The Seal Beach National Wildlife Refuge is about a 1,000-acre site. It's beautiful. If you haven't been there, you should go. It is absolutely gorgeous. It is located on the Seal Beach Naval Weapons Station, right? So part of the reason why it's so well protected is because it is literally in a naval fort, right? The Navy owns this property. It's pretty hard to mess with ecosystems that the Navy owns. As an aside, I will also say it's the only site that I've ever worked at that before you're allowed to set foot on the site, you need to take a training that tells you what to do if you find unexploded ordnances in the marsh. Now, I don't want to give it away, but the answer is don't touch it and get out of the marsh as fast as you can. So, you know, it adds a little bit of intrigue every time I'm out there. Maybe today's the day. I don't know, right? It's a gorgeous site, but it's a site that has a lot of challenges. It's a particularly low elevation site. The marsh is lower than it should be. And the reason it's lower than it should be is because, as many of you know, Southern California has a long history of oil extraction. And we've actually extracted so much oil from underneath this wetland that the wetland has sunk down a little bit. And the fact that this wetland has sunk down a little bit actually puts it at really high risk of being flooded out by sea level rise. This is a coastal wetland. It needs to deal with sea level rise, but it's so subsided that the models project that it's not likely to be able to keep pace with sea level rise. And we run a real risk of losing this marsh completely in the next 50 to 100 years or so. Right? And so the Seal Beach National Wildlife Refuge project, and this is one of the projects that's been funded by the $21 million that's come out of this regulatory carbon market because of AB 32, is trying this sort of novel management strategy called thin layer sediment augmentation. The idea here is that we're dredging the bay next to Seal Beach National Wildlife Refuge anyway. So we routinely dredge our bays. Dredging just means you take a big shovel, you go into the bay, you take all the sediment out of the bottom of the bay so the boats can go through. If anybody here is actually a dredger, I apologize. It's probably not right, but it's close enough. Right? Usually you take all that stuff out of the bottom of the bay and then you just dispose of it. You treat it like waste. In this project, instead of doing that, they're actually planning to add 10 inches of that clean dredge material back to the surface of the marsh. The idea here is that we can build back up 10 inches of elevation at this marsh and allow this marsh to have a chance now to keep pace with sea level rise. We can sort of give it a head start so that it can now keep pace with sea level rise and continue to exist past that 50 or 100 year time frame where we think it's going to go underwater otherwise. Now, is it going to work? We don't know. Right? That's why you do experiments. But we think it might, and we think it's an exciting project. There's been a number of these thin layer sediment augmentation projects on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. This is the first of its kind on the West Coast of the United States. Just a couple images, because this is just objectively cool. They dredge this site. You know, they use this big spray cannon. They drag the cannon around using this kind of marsh tank thing. And then they actually spray the dredge material using this massive hose over the marsh plain. This is called the rainbow application method for what I hope are obvious reasons. And they've managed to pull this off. So they just wrapped up the thin layer sediment augmentation a couple of weeks ago now. The image on the left shows what the marsh looked like before the augmentation. The image on the right shows what the marsh looked like immediately after the augmentation. Now, that image on the right is not overly positive, right? There is good evidence from lots of preliminary experiments that the plants here are robust enough to punch through that 10 inches of sediment. The idea here is not that we have completely smothered and killed the marsh. Let me say that again and look right at the camera. We have not killed 10 acres of marsh. Right? The idea here, they did a lot of preliminary testing to try and document this. There is good evidence that the plant communities are robust enough to punch. This is literally right after the augmentation, right? But despite the good evidence, we don't actually know what's going to happen. And we're studying the heck out of this thing. This has been a really fun collaborative project that involves a lot of universities and organizations around California. The United States Geological Survey is using these SET tables to look at how fast the marsh is accreting or sinking. There's a great group of people at Cal State Long Beach looking at that vegetation community and making sure that the vegetation community actually does come back following the augmentation. Some colleagues at UCLA are looking at how much carbon we have in the soil at this site. And at Chapman University, we're taking the lead on looking at greenhouse gas flux from this site. This is still a very new project. Two of the researchers that are doing it are in the audience today. What I can tell you is that so far, our preliminary results show that the assumption is correct. There is negligible amounts of methane and nitrous oxide coming off of this site prior to the augmentation. And this is good news if we want to move forward to this project as a way to sell blue carbon credits. Of course, we don't know what the augmentation effects are actually going to be, and that's something that we look forward to exploring in the coming years. So let me wrap up with a few conclusions here. What I've tried to do is tell you that blue carbon presents one of many examples of how we've changed our perceptions of wetlands. We've moved from a place of thinking of wetlands as Dagobah-like scary systems full of evil critters that we want to get rid of to realizing that wetlands provide a really important set of services and are valuable to have on the landscape. That changing perspective has led to some unique policy opportunities. The ability of wetlands to store carbon is now being talked about in policy circles, and I think that has some cool opportunities that might help increase conservation and restoration efforts. Those policy questions can only move forward based on sound science, and I've enjoyed working with the students at Chapman to answer some scientific questions looking at carbon storage and greenhouse gas fluxes from these ecosystems. I want to make sure that I say thank you to all the people that I need to say thank you to. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks again for the organizing committee and Jerry for the invitation to come over and do this. I never get a chance in real scientific presentations to thank the people that really matter, so I'm going to do it now. I want to thank my partner, who cannot be here tonight because she is wrangling two children at a soccer practice. But just by doing that, she allows me to come to the aquarium and give a talk, and I'm very, very thankful for that. I want to thank my two kids. That's my daughter's face. This is a slightly old picture, but I think that face represents how great it must be to have me as a dad, right? If your dad is a wetland biogeochemist, that is what your life looks like, and I'm really thankful that they put up with that nonsense on a fairly regular basis. Thank you to all my colleagues at Chapman University. In particular, I've had two wonderful postdoctoral scholars that actually do all the work in my laboratory. Thank you, Cassandra. And thanks to the amazing students that make my job so much fun. Thanks to all the other grown-up scientists that I work with on the soil carbon work and the Seal Beach Project. If I have time for questions, I'm happy to take them. Thank you so much.